Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the people of Israel. So Israel has moved out of Egypt, have been saved, and have been brought to this mountain. And there it is, at least something of what, treasured possession isn't too hard to get. It's the jewel among all of the riches. It's whatever stands out among everything else that God owns. But this kingdom of priests, this holy nation, at least says something about what's to come. So the next 20 chapters, I mean, you can see this on your outline, but the next 20 chapters are all about what it means now to live as God's people. So you have chapters 20 through 23, where God begins to give the Ten Commandments. He gives, sometimes just called the Ten Words, is the Old Testament word for it. So that he gives the Ten Commandments. He gives these other rules and statutes that go with it. Then in chapter 24, there's this kind of, some people call it a friendship ceremony. Some people also call it, it looks essentially like a marriage ceremony in some way. There's blood that's sprinkled on the altar representing God and blood sprinkled on the people saying they're now essentially one. They're connected and one in this covenant ceremony. And then after that, you have all the instructions of what it means for the tabernacle to be built. And right in the middle of that, you have six chapters of this is how we build the tabernacle. So we build the place where God's going to dwell. And then you have three chapters of what goes wrong. The golden calf incident. How if God's not going to be with these people, what are we going to do? And then the resolution to that. And then six more chapters after that of the actual building of the tabernacle. So right, everything is about what's going to happen with the presence of God. And this holy nation, this kingdom of priests, is at least something describing something of these people are supposed to be holy. They're being brought into the presence of God. They're being devoted to him in a way the rest of the nations of the earth are not. What does it look like for them to actually become a holy people? And with the mission that they've been given, if they're supposed to represent God to the rest of the world somehow, they have to be close to God. They have to be holy to God so that the rest of the nations can see the difference between them and the things that they're doing. So that's the kind of the context where we're in as far as Israel. Now, across God's one ultimate plan that he's unfolding, right, from Genesis onward, you have a creation, fail. You have basically a second creation with Noah, fail. Then you have this new creation, again, these same kinds of words, same kind of language being given to Abraham, this promise that things are going to unfold from him. And here we are, you know, these promises to Abraham as far as God is going to be his special helper. Abraham is a friend of God. And here we are, we're finding God bringing back the family of Abraham and now specially giving them his presence, putting his presence in and among them. So as you can see there on the outline, if there's one theme that kind of describes the second half of Exodus, it's that God is establishing the covenant terms to direct his people in how to live in fellowship with him since he's now going to dwell with them. All right, so God's way of making relationships is not just kind of maybe what we think about in building a friendship, right? When we think about friendships, we think about you just get to know the person and then you kind of learn more about their life until the point where there's somewhat kind of obligations to each other. You're going to call me in the middle of the night when there's a problem. I'm going to call you in the middle of the night when there's a problem. That's a deepening of a friendship. God doesn't work with quite those terms when he's bringing a relationship together in the Old Testament. He binds people together in what's called covenants. In this covenant, there's two parties, and they're making obligations of what they're going to be for each other. The same thing happened with Abraham. Same thing happened with Noah. And it, it's possible. It's not exactly true, but it looks somewhat like that's even what God was doing with Adam in the garden. So here we have a covenant relationship where people are taking an oath of what they're going to do to each other. So God's establishing the covenant terms to direct his people how to live in fellowship with him, because he's now going to dwell with them. We said this last week. The goal of the great redemption out of Egypt was so that this idea of the covenant, the I will be your God, you will be my people, that would essentially describe the relationship that God has with these people. So let's take a look at these covenant laws that Israel was to live by. First, in the second half of the book, there's a lot of these laws. I want to talk about why is it that we need to understand God's law if we're actually going to get grace. So you can see there in chapters 20 through 23, in your structure, in your outline there, this kind of general over summary in the Ten Commandments. Chapter 21 about their social life, 22 through beginning of 23 about their moral life, 23 to its end is kind of their religious calendar. This is one way that God is putting all the pieces of the nation together. So let's take a second and let's read. Flip, if you're still in Exodus 19, turn over to chapter 20. Let me read what we call the Ten Commandments. So chapter 20, and God spoke all these words, saying, I'm Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for Yahweh will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to Yahweh your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner within your gates. For in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore Yahweh blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us lest we die. So let's stop there. So the Ten Commandments, I think it's really good to ask, why does God give these commands to his people? Why, especially if he's already made an agreement with Abraham by grace, why then come and give the law? Well, remember that in the Garden of Eden, God's plan was to glory and people display his glory both to his people and through his creatures. So Genesis 12 through 50 was going to do that through a particular people. That's the buildup of Abraham's story. But they keep failing. That's what brings us to Mount Sinai. So why was the law added to God's promise to Abraham? And I'm using added because that's eventually going to take us to Galatians language. So there's two reasons, though, that this law gets added. What we read in Exodus 19. So look back over on the other page for me, but Exodus 19. Again, verse 6. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's the kind of image, that's the kind of language that reminds us that whatever God is doing in all of these laws, he's helping us think about what his character is like, how we're going to be little images of him, how we still, even with all of the brokenness and the hard-heartedness and the ruin that the curse has laid upon us, that we are still image bearers, and God is kindly, in this law, revealing a whole lot about his character, right? Kingdom of priests says something that God is establishing a people. A holy nation says something about what are those people supposed to be like. So when we talk about the law, we're talking about something righteous, something that is right, something that in whatever it's going to do is demonstrating God's character. So there's, you know, essentially God saying, here's a, as you read the law, as you're sitting in your devotions and you're reading the law and you're asking yourself, okay, what am I supposed to be learning from this? Ask yourself the question, what do these laws teach me about God's character? What do they teach me about what God is like? Why is he asking these kinds of things of his people? What good do they do his people? Now, not all the laws that are given to us in the Old Testament are necessarily specifically always saying, this is the kind of thing that exactly you should be. But all of them do show something of God's concern. Even having the Israelites later on build, you know, protections around the top of their roof. Well, yeah, Israel builds a flat-roofed house. And you know what? It's true that those are protections for those people. But it's saying something of love your neighbor as yourself. It's giving you some picture of God was concerned that people take seriously their obligations to one another. So no matter what law it is showing something about who God is and something even then of what it looks like to image, to be like him. Now, I want you to flip all the way to Galatians 3. So that's the first thing. It revealed who God is. But of course, the law gets broken. So Galatians 3, and we're going to read verses 17 through 19. All right, so Galatians 3, jumping right into his argument about the righteous will live only by faith and works cannot get a person justified. In verse 17, Paul says, this is what I mean, the law, which came 430 years afterward. After what? After the promise to Abraham. 430 years afterward does not annul it previously ratified by God. So there's the covenant with Abraham, kind of right in the fourth of what Paul is talking about. So as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it's no longer comes by the promise, but God gave it to Abraham by a promise. Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made, and it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. So we see first in those verses that the law was in no way to replace the covenant that he made with Abraham, right? That's what it said. This agreement, this law, does not nullify a previously made covenant. So it's not just one knocking out another as it goes and just building on each other. That's not what this agreement, this law, is supposed to do. Second, the law was added, it was positively added because of our sin. Right, so it says there, I flipped away for, oh, there we go. I flipped away for a second. Verse 19, why then the law? It was added because of transgressions until the offspring should come. So it's there, the law is there to make clear sins that has before not been articulated in the same kinds of way. So it doesn't do anything as far as nullifying the grace that was given to Abraham. But what it does do, and probably many of you have heard it explained this way before, it's like telling a toddler, you do not get a cookie from the jar. What happens as soon as that is explicitly told to the toddler? They push the step stool or they push the stool over from the island. They climb up on the chair. They get on top of the counter. They remove the lid. They take it and they run. There's something about the law being added. And what that does then is it brings a, not a different kind of guilt, but it brings an explicit judicial kind of guilt right to bear because an explicit command is broken. So the law, doing that in the hearts of the people of Israel and doing that as you read their testimony, you know, chapter by chapter by chapter through all of the Old Testament, gain a better understanding of exactly the kind of sinful curse and weight we bear. They, with all of the blessings that they had, in no way could actually keep the law of God. It was there and it revealed their transgressions, even with all of the gracious way that God made his presence known to them. So that's why the law is added. But I just want to make this point clear. Israel is already saved. The distinction that goes with this is God wasn't giving them the law and then saying, okay, if you do this, you'll be my special people. If you do this, everything will be right with me. Right? There's a sense in which, read this at the beginning of chapter 20. Flip back to Exodus. Just read this in the, before God gives the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 20, verses 1 and 2, he says, God spoke all these words saying, I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods. What comes first, the command or the salvation that God has delivered to them? The salvation does, right? So they've already experienced the grace. They've already been given grace. So, you know, if anything, this is it's a good reminder for us. If you read the Old Testament, do not try to use it as some kind of rule-keeping thing to make sure you are feeling God's blessing. I mean, I would hope that the constant, demeanor, posture, you know, memory in this church would constantly be hearing about you cannot somehow become the kind of person who just is going to, God's going to be pleased with you because you are following every single rule you think God needs you to follow in order to be right with him. But you know what every single one of our hearts naturally defaults to? It immediately starts defaulting towards, okay, things aren't going right in my life. What am I doing that's displeasing God? If I get those things in order, then God will be happy with me. So it takes a constant reminder of the actual gospel just to keep us from just devouring ourselves using the law, trying to somehow build up enough kind of, you know, moral fortitude, this is what I'm going to do, enough willpower to say, okay, I'm going to start doing the right things, and then God's going to flip the switch, and everything that I ever wanted in life is going to start flowing to me. It's not how the gospel works. The gospel comes to a whole bunch of us. Most of you experienced, I know from your stories, have experienced finally realizing you are morally bankrupt and God graciously providing his son as a sacrifice and then putting all of his son's righteousness on your behalf. But that also says something about how we should carry ourselves, right? The Christian doesn't carry themselves as if, okay, I've been given the greatest gift in the world. Yes, I know that. Now I need to perform for God. As if now you have the Christian life and now you need to appease him. There should be something, right, that characterizes the Christian's life as far as I now walk with a gift that wasn't deserved, but it was graciously given to me. And therefore, everything I do is simply to please him. So we don't walk to appease God, but we do walk in whatever way might please him, knowing the kind of gift that we've been given. All right, so there's a little primer on the law. Now, after you get through those laws in chapters 20 through 23, the covenant ceremony is made. So we're going to come back and we're going to end on chapter 24. But you can see on the outline there that there's kind of a large section between chapters 25 through the end in chapter 40. And you can see there it's got an arrow to it, how in scholarship they call it chiasm, or in literature chiasm, the kind of, there's something at the beginning, two points that match each other, and then as you move, there's kind of a center point of which everything is focused. These chapters do that. They center in, especially on chapter 33. But I want you to, we're going to start with chapters 32 through 34 and then come back to the tabernacle around it. So turn to chapter 32. How did the people do in keeping the covenant? This has to be one of the saddest chapters in the Bible. The people have just been given, this ceremony basically says, hey, God thinks you hung the moon and wants to make your people his bride. He wants to be in a special relationship with you. And by the time Moses is done in 40 days, they have done this. Chapter 32, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron, and they said to him, up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So Aaron said to them, right, Aaron, the strong one who even spoke before Pharaoh, such a resolute follower of Yahweh, that he then says, take off the rings of gold that are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters. Bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears, brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hands and fashioned it with a graving tool, made a golden calf. And they said, Aaron and the rest of his family or some other Levites say, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar. Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Congratulations, Aaron. Right? And when Moses comes down and actually confronts Aaron, he basically does the exact same thing that Adam did in the garden. The people made me do it. I mean, this is just the height of what sin does in someone. So, how does God respond to this kind of disloyalty, right? Because now, this is chapter 32, so they've been put into a covenant agreement with God. Verse 7, Yahweh said to Moses, go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They turned out of the way I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf, have worshipped it, sacrificed to it, said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And Yahweh said to Moses, I have seen these people. Behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. Why are they called stiff-necked? Does anyone have an idea? Why call Israel stiff-necked? It's because the principle of idolatry is you become whatever you worship. That's what I think it's Psalm, I think it's 115 says. Don't quote me on what number it is. But it says, those idols, they became like them. This is also the principle of kind of the Old Testament law of eye for eye, tooth for tooth. a punishment matches things, God allows their description and who they are to now match what they have done. They've become stiff-necked, just like the cow that they just made. And this is what's going to tag along for the rest of their existence as a people. Stiff-necked. Okay? They've broken the covenant, right? This is why Moses, when he walks down the hills, breaks the tablets in half. It's a sign they've broken the covenant. What's to come? They didn't even last 40 days. God is ready to disown them. So what is Moses' place? Right, at this point, I don't know if maybe you've read the Old Testament like I have, where you read Moses' heroics and you read these things and you kind of wonder, why is he given this? He's clearly a prophet, right? Because he's holding up the staff. He's doing all these things that bring the people out of Egypt. He's acting as a prophet. We know he's from the family of Levi, but what is Moses' role in all this? Well, he demonstrates it in verses 11 through 13. So keep following. But Moses implored Yahweh, his God, and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out? To kill them in the mountains and consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised, I will give your offspring, and they shall inherit hereafter forever. Moses' role in this story is to be the mediator that goes between the people and God. And this is what he do. And what does he appeal to when he comes before God? Does he appeal at all that the people will get better as they actually learn the law? Does he appeal to, even in all of their wickedness, if you just hang with them, right? His method of getting God, of turning his hot anger away from the people, is to appeal that God's not going to be as famous if he does it. What is it, God? And he goes on to say, what is it, God, if you pull them all the way out of Egypt, you pull them through the Red Sea, you crash every enemy that stood in their way, and then the people die? What does that say about you? He appeals to God's character, to his desire, to the thing that God said that he was doing all the time in Egypt, which was, I'm going to get glory for my name. I mean, this intercessory prayer, Moses does it once here. This is just in a small shadow, small glimpse of kind of way, this is what Jesus is doing for his people that he always lives to do in heaven on our behalf. Knowing his people, appealing to God's glory. God, you have sent me to save them. Do this for your glory. Come to their aid. Be patient with them. Love them. Now, it's very different in a lot of ways in the New Testament. This is only a shadow giving us a picture of what it looks like to be a mediator. Christ did that ultimately on the cross to change our fundamental relationship with God, where he now mainly intercedes with us as those whom he has brought along with him into the heavenly places. But still, there's a hint here. This is what it looks like to be a mediator. So God hears, and he answers Moses' God-centered prayer. And look at verse 14. Yahweh relents. And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing his people. So, does Moses stop there? Moses, for whatever might be his character flaws, has the gall to not just say, okay, Lord, don't be angry at them. And if we had read further, you'd see not even just, it's not, okay, I understand that you don't want to come with us. you have to come with us. You can't just send an angel. Your presence must come with us. But even after all of that interceding, Moses has the gall to say, show me your glory. I, individually, must see something of your glory. So it's right, I mean, in chapters 13, 12 through 23, the covenant was not just a lot of rules to be kept in exchange for some blessings. Moses was concerned that he and the people actually have a relationship with God. So chapter 33, verses 15 and 16 specifically, I just want to read for us. I mean, look, listen to Moses' cry. Mimic this cry, if nothing else. And he said to him, if your presence will not go with me, don't bring us up from here. For how is it going to be known that I have found favor in your sight and your people? Isn't it your going with us? So that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth. And the Lord says in verse 17, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. So then Moses says in verse 17, show me your glory. And you see in chapter 34, I'm just going to summarize it for us, but you see in chapter 34 that God says, you can't see my glory. You can't. But what I will do is I will make all of my goodness pass before you. And he puts Moses in some kind of cleft or cave up on the mountain, and he hides it, and he passes by, and what he hears, what Moses hears as he passes by is a voice saying, the Lord, Yahweh, Yahweh, he's making his name known, Yahweh, Yahweh, gracious, slow to anger, full of steadfast love, patient to the third, to the fourth generation, yet not allowing iniquity just to be forgotten. That refrain that he says in verse 34 is going to carry over into all sorts of things that the people of Israel are going to repeat for the rest of their history. And even that kind of characterization of God in chapter 34 is the same kind of language we use. When we say steadfast love and faithfulness is what characterizes God, which is kind of the Old Testament refrain to capture some of that saying, steadfast love and faithfulness. Do you know what happens when you get over into the book of Ephesians? Do you know what the people of God are doing when they're copying Jesus and living out their lives? They're speaking truthfulness and love. They're acting lovingly, truthfully. They're being steadfast, loving, and faithful in what they're doing. The same kind of language is then picked up even in just what we're carrying out, copying God. But it's all started here. It started here in this characterization. What does the name of the Lord mean? Gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, patience, yet not just forgetting sins gone by. All right, so now Moses gets new tablets from God. He goes back down to his people. But we're going to move to the tabernacle. So before this event, after this event, before it, it's the instructions of what the priest and the tabernacle are supposed to be consisted of. And after it, they're actually the construction of it. So I want to kind of look at it two ways. I don't think it got printed necessarily this way on the handout, but I want to look at those chapters backwards and forwards. Okay? So backwards. This construction of the tabernacle, it looks a lot like Eden. It looks a lot like being remade, a new little picture of Eden being made in the presence of the people. So open to chapter 30. So this is pre, before it's made, but look what's supposed to be characteristic of it. I'm going to read a couple of different verses. First, verse 7. These are all going to start the same, so you get used to this. Yahweh said to Moses. Verse 17, Yahweh says to Moses. Verse 22, Yahweh says to Moses. Verse 34, Yahweh says to Moses, I mean, you have our God specifically speaking to his people. Where's the last place where that was happening? Well, Abraham came before this. He had an angel of which he spoke to. He had the vision of the covenant where he heard the word of the Lord. Before that, I mean, Noah obviously had some instructions. But the kind of presence like this is when Adam heard the voice of God. Okay, but even more than that, the descriptions of it. In Exodus 25:3, Aaron is taking gold to make a tabernacle. Genesis 2 told us that was exactly what was found in the Garden of Eden. Precious jewels. Genesis 2 says there were precious jewels all over in the garden. Precious jewels adorn the tabernacle, Exodus 25:7. It's guarded by cherubim. Right on top of the ark are two giant winged cherubims on the seat, the mercy seat, guarding the tablets. It's, you know, the very presence of God. There's cherubim guarding it. What does that remind you of? The Garden of Eden. But it's not even just that. There's cherubim that are sewn or pictured into even the purple robes or purple curtains that are put up all over. Along with that, there's fruit everywhere in this thing. They're putting pomegranates into the curtains. The lampstand is in the shape of an almond tree. I mean, it's starting to scream at us, another Eden. Sabbath, here's another parallel. At the creation account in Genesis 2, 1 through 3, there's a reminder that God rested on the Sabbath. The last instruction in the tabernacle account is all focused on what? Verse chapter 31, it's all focused on the people observing the Sabbath. And of course, God's evaluation. At the end of the creation, God saw all that he made was very good. And after the tabernacle is built, Exodus 39, Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it just as the Lord commanded. This place is screaming Eden. It's screaming garden again. And of course, what was at the center of what all that was good in the garden? It was the actual presence of God, right? He walked in the midst of the cool of the day. This is what the people are regaining by being saved and then having this new covenant ceremony with God. All right, so that's looking back. Looking forward, which you have these 7 points here from the tabernacle. I want to read some of these things from chapter 29. So if you want to flip to chapter 29, I'm going to start in verse 38. And just kind of make our way through these. And I want you to be thinking about, okay, here's this Old Testament law, this picture of the tabernacle, what's going to happen inside of it? How are these shadows for what we've actually experienced? Verse 38, chapter 29, now this is what you shall offer on the altar, 2 lambs a year old, day by day, regularly. What does Hebrews tell us about day-by-day offerings? No more, right? They're done. Once for all? Agreed? Amen? Chapter or verse 42. It shall be a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Okay, so not just day-by-day. Not just one generation, not just two, not just three, not just forever, but instead, this is the characterization of how they're going to meet with God, right? You walk over, you see Jesus. Jesus says, all sacrifices stop with me. Instead, what is the way for everyone to be right with God? Can you picture him in John 14? Sitting with his disciples, them all gathered together, him announcing to them, everything else comes to pass. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Also in verse 42, you'll notice the tabernacle. Let me finish reading it. It shall be a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting before Yahweh, where I will meet with you to speak with you there. Right? Where must you go to hear from God? You got to go to the tent of meeting. Moses has to do it. How's that different from us? Number three, right? Where does God reveal himself? He used prophets. He used Moses. He's spoken to him in many ages past. No more. No more. All right. So you see some of the other ones. If you continue through chapter 21, you can see how the rest of those connect. Let me just say a word about chapter 24 before we finish and get ready to sing and hear God's word. So in chapter 24, there's this picture of blood. Blood is being used to take this special people. And blood is sprinkled on the people, blood is sprinkled on the altar. Altar representing God, the people, for themselves in this relationship. You remember how Israel talks about, or how God speaks about Israel for the rest of the Old Testament, right? The vine that he perfectly grew, he talks about him as his bride that has whored after all sorts of other women, has gone after all the other nations. Where do you think that language starts with? It's because of this ceremony in chapter 24 that he's married Israel. That's what gives so much power to when he says they've chosen other nations. Because he went through the ceremony that said, I'm never leaving you nor departing. I'm never walking out on you. And he didn't. The true Israel came. He fulfilled every promise. So as you read that, as then you start to read, you know, you go to Hosea, right? And you read the picture of the prophet having to go after Gomer and having this, you know, this prostitute as a wife and the relationship back and forth and God using it to describe his people. It comes out of this. It started here. So just think about that as you read the rest of the Old Testament, as you read and you come across other pictures where God considers his relationship with them to be so intimate. It's because he married them. He married himself to them. This is the picture of what we have as far as God's commitment to his people. All right, let's get ready for the service and go from there.